having that humility to really see where am I and what are the relevant questions and how do I draw the stories in the same way out of this city and bring people into dialogue with those stories from all over the world.
Says Catherine Nichols, who we met for another episode of Kunstpause in her office at Hamburger Bahnhof, where she is currently working as a curator after having also curated Manifesta 14 and curating the Lyon Biennial in the upcoming year. We are very happy to meet you today, Catherine.
I'm delighted to be here and to talk to you and to get to know you better. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Our pleasure.
Yes, and always we talk about a piece from the collection of the National Gallery. Today we speak about Flaka Aliti's piece Just Hanging Around. It's a significant recent acquisition by Junge Freunde der Nationalgalerie for the collection. And it's made by the Kosovo-born artist Flaka Aliti. It's a large silk curtain. And yes, I don't want to talk that much about it because, Catherine, tell us, why have you chosen this work for the collection of National Gallery?
I'm so happy that the Friends of the National Gallery bought that work. Flaka Aliti was one of the participants of the Prize of the National Gallery back in 2019. And it was such an important thing for us in conceiving the new collection presentation with Sam Badawil to really think about which artists are important to Berlin for one reason or another. And Flaka, of course, is important for that particular narrative, but also because she's living here in the city at the moment. For me personally, it had a really important significance too, because I had the privilege of working with Flaka back in Manifesta in 2022 in Pristina. That was the 14th edition of Manifesta. And I got to know her as an artist with great perspicacity. She's very observant about what goes on around her. And this particular work goes back to her participation. I think it was one of those early Berlin art fairs. Was it ABC or one of those back in 2014? And it was around the time when Wolverite was talking about Berlin being kind of poor but sexy and looking at that appeal. And she came up with this idea of showing a curtain which is made of silks, as you said. So it's really, it's fancy and it looks like the sunset. It's blue and it's pink and it's very appealing. And it's like a curtain does. It's just hanging around. It's draped from the ceiling to the floor. So it has this kind of humor to it, as much of her work does. But at the same time, it's this sharp observation of where we're at in terms of politics and economics in this city. So the one that we have was actually made in 2017. It has a different colour scheme to the first one. And when I was working with Flaka back for Manifesto in 2021, when we first started to think about the show, I had actually that work in mind. And I was really drawn to it. But then we actually decided to do a new commission and a really powerful work emerged. We can maybe talk about it later. But just coming back to that now in Berlin and remembering her importance for the city and for the collection and for the Friends of the National Gallery, it seemed like a really strong work to have, and particularly where it is. So we were working with the show with Sam and also with Till on thinking about how can we break up this phenomenon of tunnels at Hamburger Bahnhof. I think anyone who's been to the museum really knows what that's like or what it has been like in the past, that you walk into these very, very long spaces, these corridor-like spaces, where, and then you have to walk all the way back. And that sort of does something to an exhibition narrative. So what we wanted to work on is breaking that up and making this kind of circular progression. And this work is right at the end of the top floor, just where you go down the stairs and come back in this kind of circular way.
What it really does, I think, is being a border at the same time deconstructing it, right?
Exactly.
It is translucent in a way. It has, as you described it, all these shadows between the colors.
Yes.
It's about reading between the lines in a way.
Yeah. It's kind of there and it's not there. And it's a barrier, as you say. And at the same time, you can walk around it, but you can't see through it.
You tend to want to touch it, obviously.
Yeah, I think you definitely
really
people
want
are
to.
Very drawn to it. It keeps the guards busy. Just reminding people that they may not want to touch the artworks.
That's correct. Yeah. We're going to speak about artworks that you can actually touch at Hamburger Bahnhof a bit later in this conversation. But we are very interested in how you first entered the city of Berlin back in the late 90s, mm-hmm. When you actually came here to study or to profound your studies in literature.
Yes.
So you're coming from the text side of things. Mm-hmm. Firstly, could you speak a little bit about how you found the city of Berlin back then, and then also mm-hmm. how the text side of your biography is still very present in your curation?
Gosh, it's a long way back. So actually, I came to Berlin for the first time in 1993. It's a really long time ago. I think I was following in the footsteps of Australians like Nick Cave. I mean, I don't want to sound presumptuous, but I think that all of us young Australians had people like Nick Cave in mind. And we had this very romantic idea, like so many people all over the world, and people still have actually, about this city of ours, that yeah, Berlin was the place I had to go. And so I came here for the first time not so long after the wall came down and started to get to know the city. And I couldn't really find the appeal of the city. I couldn't find what Nick Cave and all that. I mean, it's sort of everyone says when you come to Berlin, you're too late. You missed it. Whenever you came, you were too late. I mean, even if you came probably at the early 20th century, you were too late. It had always already happened before you got here. And so I came, 93, and that was just to like sort of check out the city and see what the appeal was. But then I got one of these very generous scholarships in 95 from the DAAD, which is pretty much, I guess, what shaped my entire life after that. Because when I did come here, I not only fell in love with the city once I had more time and the resources that were available to me as a young student of literature, of all the libraries, for example, Stabi, just to name one, and the FU, I really was fortunate enough to actually also fall in love with a person. So that's kind of, I think it's important to say that. It's not like it's a career decision. It's a lot about the emotionality of things and being and wanting to stay in a place through all the gloominess of winter.
Right.
at the moment it's summer, so you forget that, but it's such a beautiful city.
You need some courage to do so and to decide for this.
Yes.
I mean, now that you mentioned already hanging around pretty much at different libraries of the city,
yes.
whether it be at FU or at Stabi, text is the basis of your mm-hmm. professional foundation in a way. Which role does text still play for you these days when you conceive an exhibition? Is it like, does the show start on paper?
No. No, maybe it does. I think it's always an interplay of things, actually. So it's about, I mean, I think I'm very much a visual person. So like, even though I did my PhD in about Hans Magnus Enzensberger and about poetry, I was fortunate that Britta Schmitz, actually in the early days, one of the really well-known curators, gave me an opportunity to work at Hamburger Bahnhof. And it was back in, just to explain a little bit about that. And she, even though I was an unlikely person because of, as you say, the text thing, she gave me an opportunity because of the fact that she was working on an Australian exhibition, and she thought it would be great to have somebody with this cultural understanding and sensitivity. So even though it was a long shot, she's a very intuitive person, so she gave me this chance. And from the very first day, I loved it. And precisely because it was not just about text, I felt immediately at home, even though I felt out of my depth and I thought, I don't know if I'm ever going to speak this language of the visual arts. But then I realized actually it's not so very far from poetry. An exhibition is in a certain sense like a poem because you bring things together that don't belong together, and therein lies the secret. Like things,
it's a montage.
Exactly. Yeah. And it lives through this sense of alienation and estrangement and shaking things up so that you can feel and see anew. That's the difference from walking down the street and walking through an exhibition, that it's how you bring things together. And so, I mean, poetry is already a very, very visual medium. It's a lot to do with imagery and bringing those sorts of images to mind and looking at how you meander from here to there, and what may happen on that journey. So I think that's why, even though it seemed like a long shot, it was less of a long shot than I thought it would be. And I immediately loved working in space. Actually, I originally wanted to study architecture, and then I realized and I wandered into literature.
I was going to say, probably your shows still start on paper, but not on a text page, but on a floor plan, if I get you. Is that correct?
Yes. No, it's really true. It's a lot about floor plans, and it's a lot about envisaging things and imagining things. And I think if you don't have that kind of imagination, it's really, really hard. I mean, then you get really textbook about things, and an exhibition kind of gets killed by textbookishness. Yeah.
And talking about imagination, maybe that's a good bridge to come to speak about Joseph Beuys, who obviously is so strongly linked to this house where you then, thanks to Britta Schmitz, started working and then also met Eugen Blume, as we
yes.
know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Beuys, it's all about imagination when it comes to the audience, because we are always too late, just like in Berlin. The actions have already mm-hmm. happened, right? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a complication to do shows about mm-hmm. Beuys, which you did several times. Which role does the activation of imagination play when it comes to reading Beuys or trying to understand him?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a huge question that you're asking, I think, and it's probably the reason why, I mean, dealing with this question or trying to come to terms with this question is one of the reasons that I'm still engaging with Beuys, and why it's still going to be an ongoing question, I think, forever. And I mean, I guess anybody who doesn't have that respect before Beuys is probably deluding themselves a little bit. So working with Eugen Blume, he's an extremely well-known specialist on Beuys. And when I first started, it was a similar thing with Britta Schmitz, in the sense that I didn't really know very much about Beuys at all, other than the sculptural strength of his works. And even when you don't know the actions and what's behind those works, or even having an understanding of the expanded concept of art, and that there, and Beuys thought about all of these individual pieces as being part of one great work, being the theory of social sculpture. Even if you don't know any of that, I think you know what I found when I first entered the Beuys wing back then, is the power of those individual works like End of the 20th Century with the Basalt Steels and the Palette Jack, or works like the Tram Stop, which are, I mean, just two of the very, very famous works by Beuys that we have here in the collection. So encountering those without a great knowledge of contemporary art or modern art, as was the case back then 25 years ago for me, or 25 almost, 22. I think that's where it began. So those works, they have a strength on their own, but obviously once you get to know Beuys's actions and start to piece things together and understand what he was trying to bring to people's attention, namely that we are all in a way creative individuals, that we're all artists who have the capacity to shape our environments and to influence them very powerfully. I think that's like, it's been a gradual process of understanding that and thinking, how do you activate that? How do you bring that to the audience? Even though I think each individual object has a great intelligence to it, but it's still about opening that up in some way. So, I mean, with Eugen, we've worked in so many different ways with Beuys, like bringing Beuys into dialogues with other artists, with other thinkers, not just artists in a conventional sense, but also using Beuys's own tools, which would be things like the multiples, for example, works like the Capri battery, which we have here on show, the little lemon battery, which is like a little physics class kind of demonstration. Works like that, I think, are really powerful tools to explain the essence of things. So if you get this small object, which immediately captivates people, it's very simple but complex at the same time, it's visually appealing, it's kind of funny. And I think that integrating a work like that can really help people to understand, but also showing the actions from which he derives these works. Say, for example, just to go back to what I said before about the End of the 20th Century with the Basalt Steels, which comes out of the work for Documenta in 1982, the 7,000 Oak Trees, which is one of the most famous examples of social sculpture and well-loved. Yeah, then we also have that in conjunction with the video where Beuys shows the action, and you can have the opportunity to hear him talking about it and to see how these things relate, and that one is a relic, but it still sort of has this sort of the energy and the spirit of what went before.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. I love this new sound archive, which yes. you probably also worked on, yes. right? In the Kleinhushalle.
Yes.
Yeah, it's definitely yes. worth for our audience to check yes, it out. And also speaking about the dialogues, which you just mentioned, I mean, I think this is definitely a continuous mm-hmm. red line in the exhibition practice here at Hamburger Bahnhof
yes.
to bring boys in new dialogues with contemporary artists.
Right? Yes, I think that was one of the really great decisions that Sam and Till made when they came to Hamburger Bahnhof. Was like part of sort of breaking up this kind of tunnel thing and beginning in one place and ending in another was really sort of going that you enter the Kleinhushalle, for example, in the middle. And that they thought, okay, it's great to have this permanent collection there. Many, many people come to Berlin, especially to see the works by boys and to see them in a way that sort of gives them an opportunity to really enter. And also the whole controversial nature of Beuys as an artist, not just this kind of, oh, beautiful sculptural appeal, but also the fact that he's a, you know, highly contested artist in many ways, and to try to understand that why, and also how you can continue expanding Beuys, so to speak, in the same way that he expanded others like Goethe and Marx and all manner of people. But I think it was such an intelligent decision of Sam and Till to say, yeah, let's not only think in those ways, but think about which contemporary artists either engage with Beuys directly or build on perhaps some of his legacy, or actually like Andrea Pichel, for example, really kind of come head to head with Beuys in and really question whether that mightn't have been perhaps an extremely arrogant way that he engaged with East German history. I mean, that's an open question. I'm not answering it, but I think it's really, really valid to raise those questions and to see mm-hmm. where that takes us, and to challenge ourselves and our viewers to really like think their way into such difficult questions, and which are eminently important politically for where we are now in this city, in this country, in this continent,
yes,
on this planet.
In your work, you have a focus on also reorganizing the collection of Hamburger Bahnhof. We talked about Flakaliti and the representation of the collection. I mean, Hamburger Bahnhof is kind of a new museum. It's getting 30 next year. So it was opened in the end of the 90s. And I think about how it changed in the last years and what is the actual focus on collecting and doing also exhibitions here. I see a focus on Eastern Europe, and I see also a new direction of bringing things together. Can you tell us more about this?
I'd love to. So, I mean, that's also a really big question, I guess. And I think it's something that I've seen happen for many, many years. I mean, it doesn't just begin with Sam and Till, of course. I think that there have been many steps in this direction, but one of the critical things has been focusing a lot on acknowledging place, acknowledging the fact that we're in Berlin and who lives in Berlin and who's shaping the art world here. It's not just Eastern Europe in a way, like it's people from everywhere, because we know how many diverse backgrounds of people shape this city and give it the character that draws people from everywhere to want to be here and gives it that energy. So that's something that I think that we decided that we wanted to focus on with Sam and Till in particular. That was the direction that they set when they were first starting here. So, I mean, I joined them in that. I don't want to claim ownership of that idea, but I like the idea and I wanted to be part of that. So first thing that we really thought about was like, what works do we already have in the collection? And that's somewhere you can really say that has a lot to do with the Friends of the National Gallery, because a lot of the works that we do have of recent works in the collection come with the support of the Friends of the National Gallery. I mean, that's when you really look at the history of that, like what did we actually manage to acquire? It was thanks to that, but so it was like picking up on that and really concentrating all our attention through fundraising on how we could expand that. And that means like firstly diversifying, particularly where it comes to minorities and women. You know, it's a typical collection story that I think institutions all over Germany and all over the world have. Ultimately, when you look in the collections, there's this massive imbalance. And so it's been partly about redressing that. I mean, how do you go about that? Because it's such a huge task. So it's not like you can say, oh, okay, let's get the quotas happening. It was more like that we thought, let's try and tell the story of this city. Just say, just before the German reunification, just before everything opened up, that threshold, that exciting sort of threshold situation through to the present. And starting with what we have and then seeing who's missing in the story, actually. Mm-hmm. So it was really the exhibition itself, and it will be again next year when it's reshuffled again and rethought, reimagined for the 30-year anniversary. That will be the second phase of that, where it'll be about seeing which voices, which positions, which parts of the story are missing for the new chapter. Mm-hmm. And then I think, and then again, that will happen again and again. And so that the collection grows in a kind of meaningful way. But we're always thinking not just for the story of the exhibition, like obviously it has to be twofold or multifold, that you say, yes, it's great for the story in the exhibition, but at the same time, it's really important for our collection, something that's sustainable, something we can actually even take care of, because they're really important concerns, works that we can store, works that are going to be meaningful for, on a long-term basis.
Sustainable or even ephemeral, so to speak, when it comes to your, one of your next projects here at Hamburger Bahnhof, which is An Opera Out of Time by Petri Talilai. Can you tell us about how this project started and why you wanted to invite him to do this? Mm-hmm. And what this opera in the title will be actually about?
Yeah. What is this opera about? Well, it begins with the question that we just raised. So Petri Talilai is an artist who's been living in Berlin since, I think, around about 2010, or like maybe 2009. He shot to fame around 2010. I think you probably remember this, and many people do, that he was part of the biennial in 2010, and he had this really exciting installation. It was so fresh. I think it was in Katrin Romberg's edition. And she has a really good knowledge of the region that Petri comes from. And she invited him to do an installation in KW, in Kunstwerke Berlin, in the main hall. And people were blown away by this because it was the frame of the house, like the skeleton of the house that Petri had built with his money as an artist, the early earnings for his parents in Pristina. So that's a very complex history behind that. But in any case, the house was raised up like this kind of floating object, like a dream, like a spaceship, also ephemeral, as to come back to what you were saying, Felix, and with these chickens. And that was what blew people away. There were these chickens running around. And they were also, they had a nice kind of time of things because they also had a beautiful backyard to run in and out of. So it was an unusual approach at the time. People were really excited by it. And I was just one of the many people who saw that and thought, who's Petri Talilai? Who's behind this? And then it was years and years and years before we actually got to meet and got to know each other and work together. Again, Manifesta, interestingly. And there we had this fantastic collaboration on an intervention at the Grand Hotel. That's a hotel in the center of the city that ethnic Albanians were excluded from for many years, although they had these fond memories of it. And everyone walked by it every day, but for decades people didn't go in. Very contested, very violent history. And the five stars that this hotel once had came down one by one, and it was a no-star hotel in a way. So Petri reimagined that. Like it's the typical approach that he takes, which is what I'm drawn to. It's like, how do you look at a situation that may seem so fraught and so at the end of the road and look at it and see the beauty or see the humor or see the potential for transformation. And there you see the link again to Boyce. And see the potential for transformation. And so what he did is he picked up those stars and he made this like glitter out of it. Firstly, he rearranged the letters on top of the hotel from Grand Hotel Pristina into making a sentence that said, when the sun goes away, we paint the sky. So I think like transforming this kind of post-war transitional narrative into one of great beauty and optimism, and then multiplied the stars. So five stars became hundreds of stars, and they, all of these like little light boxes, these stars then were spread out all over the city, like, as I said, like glitter, like this beautiful new constellation. And now these stars are traveling all over the world and being reinstalled in different constellations. So that's, it's like this kind of like embracing, inviting work. So this is how Petri and I got to know each other. It was a really intense, beautiful, imaginative dialogue. And I had that in my mind, and I proposed to Sam and Till whether we might not want to do a solo show with Petrit, because strangely enough, he's never had an institutional, major institutional show in Berlin, his own city, mm-hmm. where it's, he's made his at his own.
While he traveled the world with solo shows, even in Mexico City, I saw his show.
And you saw it,
yeah,
did
I
you?
Saw it. And I think it's really an artist that is so bespoken at the moment.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, you're so right about that. You're so, and how fortunate that you got to see the show, because I've just seen...
I will show you pictures later.
So beautiful. I think it's... Yeah, and that was... and also one of actually the first shows where Petrit showed many works and many bodies of work, but in a very different way from how we're approaching it in Berlin. And that's how, I guess, we get to the opera. So in Mexico, what you would have seen, Felix, is the fact that Petrit's work and is populated by all of these characters and there and by these immersive environments. So there he had all of the characters kind of in this very like wild arrangement, like a menagerie or like a zoo or something, but not crazy or chaotic, very finely arranged nonetheless, with an energy between all of the characters. But here what we're doing more is like looking at the evolution of this approach to theatre, which culminates in the opera. So from the very first characters, like these costumes that Petrit came up with to wear himself, like birds, often winged creatures, a canary or moths that enabled him to kind of hide or be somebody else and to test out what it feels like to walk around with those very different qualities, like winged qualities, birds that can fly and are not contained by borders, that can occupy the sky and are not constrained by the things we are constrained by in difficult political situations on Earth. And so what we're really exploring is how does he then go from these immersive environments and characters to theatrical sort of situations that invite people, other people to enter into and sort of dream with him, like in this collective dreaming, through to theatrical projects. Maybe we can talk a bit more about that in a moment, like that sort of paved the way for the opera and the opera, which called Surigana, the name of a village. More on that in a moment. And this and turning this opera into something that was performed in the landscape, not in an opera house, outside in the village where Petrit's mother comes from, and then bringing it to Hamburger Bahnhof and transforming it into an installation that people kind of don't experience in the same way, because the characters have become sculptural, but it's activated in very different ways through the libretto, through the lighting, which becomes a character in its own right, and through this immersive environment that you don't sit in front of, but you sit within and walk through and activate by your own movement and engagement with the individual sculptures.
So we are becoming part of it.
Yes.
And there she goes again, the social plastic,
yes.
social sculpture,
actually,
right?
Yeah, you're right. It looks like this is all planned.
It all comes down to voice in the end.
Petrit is also working together with the Kosovo Philharmonic
yes.
for this opera project. So we'll hear music kind of? Or
it's a really wild, multi-layered project.
Yeah.
So what happened was we were thinking to reactivate a work of theatre that Petrit did in the House of Culture in Runik, where he was actually born and grew up. And then just coincidentally, he was approached by the Paris Opera to perhaps take part in a residency and develop a scenography. And then almost at the same time, he was approached by Kosovo Philharmonic, by the director Dadan Selimai, who said, you know, we're turning 25 next year. The Kosovo Philharmonic was formed just after the war. Is it like a post-war transitional cultural project? So we're turning 25. And he was remembering these beautiful flowers that Petrit and Alvaro made together. And we show here at Hamburger Bahnhof as part of the collection presentation. Mm-hmm. So Dadan was just thinking about the flowers.
Maybe then, Alvaro you're referencing is...
Oh, Petrit's husband, Alvaro Urbano. And they work together sometimes. They have a collective practice and also each an individual practice. Yeah. So anyway, Dadan was looking at the space where the flowers had been installed in the National Library. They were standing there for an event. And Dadan said, you know, wouldn't it be lovely if you made a scenography for us with the Kosovo Philharmonic for our special celebration in 2025? And Petra's like, well, you know, as a matter of fact, I'm actually working on a show at Hamburger Bahnhof. And wouldn't it be beautiful to bring my home country and my new home country, or two home countries in a way, mm-hmm. together in this beautiful collaboration and project. Mm-hmm. And so that's how this opera came about. What was going to be theatrical became operatic, how the music came in. So the Kosovo, to answer your question, Charlotte, mm-hmm. it was really about how the Kosovo Philharmonic actually performs the music that people hear in the exhibition. So they performed it in the landscape, and that was recorded. And that's what people will hear when they come and be within, as Felix said, like within the opera.
How does this international and interdisciplinary collaboration you described influence what we talked about beforehand, the broader mission of Hamburger Bahnhof, the mission of bringing things together, being international, putting things from the city in kind of a melting point here together? So is this maybe a wonderful example for the mission of Hamburger Bahnhof at the moment?
I think it is. I think that's something I also really appreciate about what Sam and Till set themselves as a goal, and set all of us actually as a goal, and we willingly set ourselves mm-hmm. also as a goal, is to open up the institution in every way that we can imagine, to being an inclusive place, but also a place that learns from other places. And in a very humble kind of way, I think it's not just like saying, okay, we are in dialogue with, but it's actually about saying, what does that mean? And how, without knowing the result beforehand, how can we just open ourselves to certain processes and learn from those? So I love the fact that Sam and Till were like so open to this possibility. Their enthusiasm and support in these kinds of things is really very unusual and very special. So they were like immediately in favor of this idea of let's go with it. Let's see if we can make this happen. And through a lot of dedication from everybody, and particularly Petrit and his studio, that kind of became possible. And now the Kosovo Philharmonic will also come to perform here live in springtime. So towards the closing of the exhibition, they'll be here. So it's not just the fact that their music was performed in the landscape and recorded. It's that those individuals who were all involved and will come here and play, and everybody gets to spend time with one another and actually have those very personal encounters, which are a really important part of our job and what we do.
Mm-hmm. I guess as much as you just described this interdisciplinary and international approach as one of the missions, as mm-hmm. you put it, of Hamburger Bahnhof, it is also the curatorial practice of biennials, mm-hmm. of manifestas.
Yes.
Maybe you could speak a little bit about what role these, let's say, extracurricular, or I wouldn't know how to describe it better, projects of yours that you do besides your work at Hamburger Bahnhof, what role they play for you as a curator, or maybe also to differentiate how biennials or a manifesta project is different from working within the fixed cadre of an institution.
Mm-hmm. So manifesta is a very particular biennial. It's one that moves from city to city, as you know, every 2 years. It's in the European Nomadic Biennial. So it always goes in a very situated way into different cities and tries to get to know those cities and to understand, to learn from what's there and what people would desire. Because each of those cities puts in a bid. That's something people don't realize. It's like the Olympics. So the cities actually put in a bid and say, like, what would they love to achieve with the biennial? And then the manifesto does a study for a couple of years on the city, a really intense sort of urbanological study. And then the task of the creative mediator, as the curator's called, is to then respond to that research and see how to bring it to life. So that, for me, that was I'd never done such a project before. So I was so, again, grateful to have that opportunity to work with Hedwig Fay and the director and the whole team. And what was really appealing to me, and this is, I guess, probably the crucial point, is that Hedwig was always referring to the entire history of manifesta, that was the 14th. And so when I first met her, she was saying, okay, so this manifesta in this city, we sought to do this, and this worked, and this didn't work so well. We learned from that, and then we tried this, and then we tried that. And so each experimental format, always shifting, was a bid to try to rethink what can a biennial actually be. Because I think you realize, like an exhibition, it's such an open question. It's such a fluid form that is sort of innately incomplete. And you have to keep reworking it and rethinking it and pushing mm-hmm. the boundaries of it. So that's what actually made me very attracted to have a go at it.
Yeah, and I guess it's also pretty much because it's traveling as a format, it's got to do a lot about audience development. I'm sorry about this very technical term, but you really need to connect with the city.
Yes.
And connect with its public.
Yes. Yeah, and that was also for me a really crucial learning experience too, to think, to look, to go to Pristina and to learn just some of the statistics, and that's that people aren't used to having trust in public institutions or public spaces, and a very small proportion of people actually knew or related to the National Gallery, for example, like a really typical art institution. People much more relate to, like, everywhere, actually, as Berlin's no different, to the shopping mall, to that's a place people feel much more welcome at, weirdly, or maybe not so weirdly, but than at a museum. So it was, for me, it was really crucial to just, like, just sort of let go of everything that I thought I knew and then just try to listen really hard to people and to see what's appealing, not just to, like, trying to make a museum a shopping mall, to the contrary, but more just thinking, like, what is it about the mall that makes people feel uninhibited? How to make those spaces welcoming, how to give them a threshold that people would dare to cross or desire to cross. And a lot about storytelling and sort of, like, just really working with what's there, because all of those buildings we worked with in Manifesta, they all have their own story and they're all captivating in their own way. So it was really just about, like, looking really carefully, listening really carefully, drawing out the stories of what's there, like, just the what's already there. And drawing people into dialogue with those things in an inviting way and not a super didactic
But really,
way.
The city and its audience becoming your material in a way to, or material is the wrong term.
Yeah, the city, I guess you can think of maybe as a material or as a character, almost like a character in the story.
Certainly not its inhabitants,
But the people that, the people that just, like, are people you would want to invite into a conversation or just, like, to... in a way to meet up with and to see how this kind of collective thinking or how a good conversation can go. Can it take us somewhere? Can it take us beyond some of these obstacles that I think all societies face in terms of being afraid of one another, in terms of withdrawing from political participation when it seems really difficult and fraught and it's not possible to have a conversation? And so that's why I felt that these kinds of, like, really captivating things in public space, that even just say, like, Ugo Rondinone wrapped the Brotherhood and Unity monument in the middle of town in this very beautiful pink foil, and that just got everyone talking. So that's where people go to have ice cream with their grandchildren, or where children go to have ice cream with their grandparents that way around. And people were just sitting there and saying, this is beautiful, because everything was bathed in a pink light. So even if you don't sort of go into this layer of thinking, what is the significance of wrapping a really contested monument of Yugoslav and sort of ideals of brotherhood and unity in a place that's been ravaged by war, and where there's this whole sort of discourse around what should a monument stand for in today's times? Should it be about militant resistance? Should it be about peaceful resistance? Should the monument be knocked down? There you see just this wrapping it in something very appealing has people just sitting down there for a start. And once you sit there and talk about what's this all about, then it really sort of launched this dialogue, and everyone in the city was talking about this monument, which had sort of become really fraught and stuck. So that's what I really like about this biennial, as this possibility with a very small shift that changes everything.
To have an impact, yeah. I mean, our listeners can definitely go on Google Picture to dig up these images. They you will find them easily. What monuments are you facing in Lyon, in the beautiful city of Lyon, which obviously has its biennial going on since years? Tell us how you will play with that city.
Well, I'm at the stage at the moment of getting to know the city in the same way that I was spend a lot of time getting to know Pristina. But you're right, like, I can imagine that you're thinking what we're all probably thinking, and that there couldn't be two more diametrically opposed cities. I mean, Pristina's very sort of open and raw still, and the city where you really have this sense of becoming, and it's very palpable, and Lyon's very settled and quite wealthy, affluent city. It's an economic powerhouse. France in a way, and two rivers flow together. Pristina doesn't have a river, so yeah, it's the kind of was launched a place where really the Industrial Revolution was launched. So it's a lot about
former factories, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Former factories. It doesn't seem to have as many rundown spaces, so it's a really different way of approaching the city and a different way of reading monuments, for example, and really thinking about what kind of questions are relevant. But I think I'm not allowed to reveal at this stage what the biennial is about. We're going to be announcing that later this year. But I can definitely say that it's in the same way that I approach Pristina, and which is what I really learned, I think, and made sense to me, is to really understand the city before you begin to want to engage with that city, having that humility to really see where am I and what are the relevant questions and how do I draw the stories in the same way out of this city and bring people into dialogue with those stories from all over the world, because I think it's as important to think about Lyon as a place as to think about how Lyon fits in with planetary concerns and questions. So it's kind of, I'll always be starting from the place in the same way. But unfortunately, I can't tell you exactly what I'm going to do yet. It's to be announced.
Let's put it like that. You're still in the reading phase. Yeah.
Exactly.
In the reading stage.
But, yes. But isn't this what you described as getting to know a city better and getting to know the art audience and people in the city better for making art shows in context of Manifesta or some other art shows? Isn't that also characteristic for an institution? Only the fact that, yeah, okay, we cannot change our place here. Maybe our focus mm-hmm. on in Berlin, but the character of knowing the art audience, yeah, getting to know the city and the neighborhood better and involving them for showing things, isn't that very similar to a kind of festival art show like Biennale or Manifesta?
I think you're right. I think you're totally right, actually. And I guess that's why I appreciate the experience so much for learning for that mm-hmm. from that, actually, for my yeah. whole work as a curator. I think early on, what I haven't mentioned, which is kind of, I guess, has been formative for me, was working a lot in cultural history exhibitions. I worked a lot for the Huginer Museum in Dresden. After I started working at Hamburger Bahnhof, I started to work all over Germany in different kinds of exhibitions. And it was such an instructive thing because they had a very different audience. So I remember when I first started working there, they were saying, okay, Frau Nichols, you know, it's like, you're going to have audiences like from 5 to 95. They're going to be people from all different backgrounds, lots of school classes, people who know nothing about art, da, da, da. Like, in a way, that's you could say that about any museum, actually, but that was where it became really clear to me that we were looking at a really broad audience and it's about inviting everyone into a conversation and not being elitist and exclusive and just doing good storytelling with objects and not just artworks. So it was like how to sort of also not just sensitively approach audiences, but sensitively approach the objects and their works and their all, because they all come with a very complex story. I mean, every little object, as we know, like it's embedded in this whole sort of material history and emotional history, intellectual history. So yes, I think you're so right. And that really helped me a lot for curating art exhibitions as well, mm-hmm. because you can't imagine you're in any bubble. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think sometimes we forget in art museums. You can be a bit bubble-like in your approach, and it's really good to get out of that and shake it off immediately. And so I think that was the first step in this direction, and the biennial again, that really was like going another layer deeper in this kind of learning process that I will say is never going to be finished. I think it's an ongoing thing to learn how to make a better exhibition, how to be a better curator, how to be a better listener, that's probably why it's such an appealing job and why it's such a fascinating job, because it's so, you will never get there.
How to fail better.
What is your favorite museum?
The Mac Lyon, because I'm working there and I'm really trying to get to know it and I'm delving into the collections, and I think that there's always this appeal of the new.
What is your favorite place? It could be also your favorite place for the moment.
I'm really fond of Tiergarten. I have a dog, Indy, And my partner and I love walking the dog in Tiergarten, and I think it's one of the most beautiful places in Berlin. It's not just my favorite now, it's been my favorite for decades.
Are you currently learning something new?
Yeah, I'm really trying to understand techno-feudalism. It's this idea by Yannis Varoufakis, and who suggests that capitalism is dead, and it's really hard to understand, like, why is capitalism dead? And he has this idea that now, I mean, we've seen it a little bit with Elon Musk and the power and this sort of tech bro culture, how we have re-entered a kind of feudal society where it's not about labor and the typical economic relations, but it's about rent. And cloud rent specifically. So that's what I'm in the process of trying to understand.
What is something you've recently failed at?
I'm really practicing trying to say no, because I'm very, I love people and I love being involved in things. So I'm really trying to say no a little bit so that I can focus more on individual tasks. But I'm failing at that on a daily basis. And sometimes I try to say no and then people ask me a second time and then I say yes. So I'm really, really working on saying no in a nice way and sticking with it.
What are you currently curious about?
I'm curious about how people are going to respond to Petrit's opera. We've been working so hard on this for the past year, and we want to know if it's going to bring about the same social change or perhaps launch the same sort of political thought process that his previous theatrical work did back in 2018. It was about dreaming the house of culture in Runic back to life. It was in ruins, and now it's actually being restored, and Petrit has somehow managed to set this process in motion through a lot of hard work and dreaming. So I'm really curious to see whether this opera has a chance of setting something similar in motion.
Hold on to this curiosity. I'm sure the audience of this podcast will attend very soon.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Catherine, for the conversation.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I've loved talking to you.
And thanks to you for listening. We'll be back with the next episode in the next month. Start following us on Instagram if you don't do so far, and we'll be back.